This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Well, thank you everybody for coming today. I'd like to welcome you to our December staff seminar and particularly welcome people who've come from outside of the museum. It's great to see you here. My name is Anne Farris and I work in the Research Centre. I'm going to shortly hand over to Dr. Daniel Oakman, one of our senior curators in the People and Environment team, who will welcome our guest speakers. They'll speak for 40 minutes and then we'll have some question time. The session, as you can see, will be recorded. The intention is that that goes on the web. I'd also just like to draw your attention to our book display, as you can see, along here. Feel free to have a look at that afterwards. It's been put together by Noel and Naomi and Janet, our fabulous librarians. Thank you, Daniel.
Thanks, Anne. Thanks, everyone, for coming along. I'm delighted to introduce our two speakers today, Professor Angela Russo and Dr. Stephen Fleming. Angelina is a designer and professor of cultural practice at the University of Canberra, and she also runs a micro business called Cycling Cultures, which designs high-vis handmade cycleware. Dr. Fleming is a senior lecturer at the School of Architecture and Design at the University of Tasmania, where he leads bike-focused design studios and supervises PhD students in bike-orientated topics. He's also the author of an incredibly interesting book called Cycle Space, which is up here on the display. Just by way of introduction, when I first met Angelina a few months ago, I was particularly excited by their research, not just because of my own particular interest in cycling and in cycling history, but really due to the highly original and innovative dimensions of their work. And in many ways, I felt that the approach they were taking was really challenging many of the debates that have been centred around cycling over the last 10 years and really taking them in new and interesting directions. And I think their work does this because it really uses cycling as a way to interrogate some of the major trajectories of modernity and modern life in the 20th century from both a historical and a cultural perspective. And I think it starts to imagine cycling in relation to a range of critically important themes like public health, transportation, obesity, urban congestion, the road toll, pollution, and of course, climate change. But I think at its heart, their research starts to look at the impact of modernity on our own bodies and in particular, the perception of our own bodies. And it's in that sense that I really think it starts to open up, you know, fascinating pathways. So I'm sure we'll see in their talk that there are rich areas for collaboration with the National Museum, as these issues that they address are vitally important to cultural institutions. And I think that we, in particular, have a great role to play in tackling many of the same questions that they'll be raising today. So over to you, Angelina.
Thank you so much, Daniel, and thank you so much to Kirsten and to Daniel and for organising today, and to Naomi and Janet for bringing this fantastic range of books. Stephen and I have, in fact, we met on the web, Stephen and I. We met on the web. A couple of years ago, I started to develop a range of high-vis cyclewear, knit and crochet, and put up a blog and found that Stephen was also speaking about cycle spaces and was an architect and as a designer, it was very interesting to find someone who I could talk to about the impact of cycling on our cities, but also how design could be used as a mechanism for developing new typologies for our cities and the like. And as a result, we have formalised that relationship over a series of talks now and are preparing for a discovery grant application in February of next year, as well as having now written a number of abstracts for some papers for next year for the Velo City and Museums Australia conferences. Today we're going to talk about a bit of that research, and as you can see, Stephen has very, very generously prepared some models to illustrate some of the ideas that have been coming out of that talk, out of those discussions. So as a kind of way of starting, Australians love speed. We love it. We'll pay for it. We'll pay for the opportunity to sit and be hot and sweaty in fast cars that that will give us, what does it feel, the excitement and the G-force of the V8 performance. It's a very, very Australian way of approaching mobility. And yet, for the most part, this is actually the reality of our mobility. And in some places in the world, this is the reality of mobility. This is a shot taken in 2010, just outside of Beijing, where there was a 100-kilometre, 12-day traffic jam. For 12 days, people sat on that freeway. It's just an extraordinary idea. I know. It's just horrific. And yet, at the very same time, the reason that I even saw that was that it was on the news in China. I was in Shanghai for Expo 2010, and this was in the Hudong area, which had just literally just been rebuilt. And I was told that no heavy traffic was allowed into Shanghai during the Expo, the 3 or 4 months of Expo in Shanghai. And so whilst these new brand spanking new roads and elevated walkways had been built, there was no real sense of exactly how congested they would be. But what I did discover was that the real mobility of Shanghai was absolutely still there. The elevated walkways that had been built to allow people to walk were actually lined all the way underneath with bikes. And I thought that was quite beautiful. Shanghai, as I said, was basically rebuilt for Expo, including 8 new train lines, not just platforms, complete lines, in the period of about 5 years, which in itself is also an extraordinary thing. But what I find very interesting about this shot is that it's so reminiscent of this one. And the idea of the elevated walkway, in this case this is a shot from Metropolis, Fritz Lang's film from the 30s, which imagined a future city where in Fritz Lang's future the workers lived underground and the elite lived above ground. And throughout science fiction and throughout architectural history as a result, we've seen a number of different imaginings of our cities. On the right, Frank R. Paul's City of the Future cover illustration, which, to be honest, when I see this image on the right-hand side in particular, always reminds me of the new structures in Shanghai. And to the left, the aerial city, which you will be pleased to know, though it's quite difficult to see, right here, right there in the centre, it says museum. So I take great delight in that image, because it suggests that culture sits absolutely at the centre of the imaginings of our new cities. Interestingly, on the left-hand side, we have an image from the development of the fast rail system in France in the 1940s. I find it interesting because today when we talk about fast rail and we talk about kind of new forms of transport, it's tremendously pedestrian. And yet, the image on the left really offers a kind of an imagining, if you like, of what a future transport system might be. And similarly, on the right-hand side, an image from the 1930s of what a future worker might be. And to be honest, I think that's what I feel like most days. And of course, these imaginings eventually found their way into our cities, and the Seagram building on the right-hand side in New York, a very famous piece of architecture, really epitomised that idea of that typology with people living in the sky and the mobility, the car parking and the lights, sitting underground. And to the left, the first of those kind of prototypes of those new environments in Dessau through the Bauhaus. In the 70s, we left it to the Italians to find a way of imagining a new city, and this was the radical architecture of Superstudio and Archizone in particular. The idea of the 10 cities. And what they were doing was not offering a proposition, a genuine proposition for what future cities would look like, but rather a series of propositions for what events and activities occurred within cities and how they might be imagined as a utopian image. To the right, the City of Order, taking on, of course, everything that the Bauhaus taught us about materiality and order and construction, and to the left, the City of Brains. So Akism, really, what was also very interesting about them was not only did they reimagine a utopia and a city, a series of cities, through their architecture, but they were very much, their urban forms arose out of a consumer market and not town planning. And they were very influenced by dress design, which they signified in that very particularly Italian way as a branch of urban design. And they were looking very much at experiments with collective culture. And I guess that's what we're trying to capture in some ways with the work that we're doing, this sense that how do you reimagine a city? This is a shot from a cycling tour that I ran in Sydney just recently. And it's a series of tours that I run with my colleague on the right-hand side there, who is Gilbert Grace is an artist and runs outside with Sydney. And it's a series of tours that we've been doing for a number of years now where we take people to cultural institutions and to cultural sites throughout Sydney and basically reintroduce them to the city through bikes. I think recently we wrote a paper for, an article for The Conversation where we were talking about what reimagining Australia by bike might look like. And we talked about bike races such as L'Eroica in Italy, which is essentially a bike race which has been established to promote the conservation of the white gravel roads in the Tuscan hills, and has taken on a kind of cult status, if you like, in that with L'Eroica you can only enter the 200 kilometre cycle on a bike that is pre-1980s. You find much in the way of leather cycling shoes and woolen jumpers, and of course when you get to the top of the hill there aren't any energy packs. There's food, there's wine, there's coffee, and a very beautiful thing. And so in this article we're saying what might an Australian imaginary look like, and this is a beautiful shot from Tasmania. And what might it look like if we were thinking about a place like Canberra, where we have not just extraordinary landscape, but a series of really quite beautiful civic buildings? How might we reimagine that? And on that note, I'm going to pass over to Stephen to talk to us about that reimagining.
The next presentation, so I guess I press escape. I'm just sort of guessing as I go, but I'm going to trust that. Look at this, so close now. Where's the little presentation? Oh, nice. I see it. Testing. There we go. Thank you. What a brilliant setup. 1, 2, 3. Let's hope I can deliver. All right, so that's the book and that's me. I'm particularly interested in brownfield redevelopment because Australia is, well, Canberra might be the one exception, is a city of post-industrial cities which have surplus brownfield sites. They're very large, they're interconnected by bulk transportation routes like rail lines and waterways which are being turned into bicycle routes. So they have a particular importance. OECD have recognised the importance of these to compact cities, so rather than just letting cities sprawl, we need to backfill them. Now, how you backfill them is the issue. What we call urban morphology, in other words, the form of the city, the kinds of buildings that we've got, is really an outworking of the mobility platform that underpins that city. So the first thing a planner does is work out how people are going to connect to each other, how they're going to meet. And a city is designed so that people can get together, as we are right now. So if the urban mobility platform is walking, you'll get a very fine, dense, low-rise, height site coverage kind of city like Groningen in the Netherlands, which is thought of as a bike city, but it was really designed for walking. If the mobility platform is driving, you'll get something like Los Angeles or Canberra, as it's turned out, or most Australian cities as they sprawl. Cities that fancy themselves as progressive, like Copenhagen and their brownfield redevelopment area of Ørsted, which is a huge one, it's the largest brownfield redevelopment area in Europe, they fancy that they have a multi-pronged approach, so that they're designing for walking, transit and cycling. And you see all the bicycle infrastructure and the train infrastructure going in. However, is it really based on a transit-oriented platform? The building on the left by Bjarke Ingels, a star architect at the moment, shows really what's underpinning it. And Canberra's the same, that we have a lot of apparently walkable utopian buildings, but underpinning them is heaps and heaps of car parking, and the car parking's oriented to a road. And really, most of the trips in Ørsted are made by car. Even though you can cycle and you can take the train, it is still based fundamentally on an automotive mobility platform. And it's getting the kinds of buildings that you would expect. And, you know, the other things are kind of superficial. Rotterdam is a city that has perfect bike culture, perfect bike infrastructure. You can cycle wherever you want, perfect train connections. Yet 56% of people use cars. That's the way, it's the dominant mode of transportation, because there's underground car parking connected to roads, and driving is possible. And driving has a lot of advantages. Just ask any mother with children on a rainy day. So that's why people drive there. And in Australia, we're up against this. And we're not going to stop it. You know, it is always going to be possible to drive. Rotterdam as well, a friend of mine at TU Delft, Stefan van der Spek, has hooked tracking devices to people who live in condominiums in Rotterdam, and has found that they're not walking out of their apartments and patronising local cafes or going to the train station. They're going down to the basement, getting in their car and driving out to the suburbs, because they have that opportunity to do that. So Rotterdam really typifies this kind of thing. So we're moving... We are seeing a lot of inner-city urban consolidation, people moving back to the city centre, but the kinds of buildings that we're building are connected to roadways and they provide lots of basement parking. It's a vision of urban consolidation that dates to the interwar period and really entered the cultural imaginary through, I think, the key moment, although there were lots of moments, but a standout moment was the Futurama exhibition at the 1939 New York World's Fair. 28,000 people per day came through this exhibition. It was the highlight of the World's Fair. America goes off to World War II, comes back and basically builds it. And now we've entered the urban consolidation phase of our cities. We're still working with this vision that dates to the interwar period, because cars were so essential to the good life. And you can see, you know, how powerful it was. I guess the older we are in our population, the more, you know, the closer this memory is to us. Some young people are sort of drifting away from it. People in power certainly are holding on to it. The magic of this vision was that they were talking about freeways that would let you drive at 150 miles per hour in absolute safety, and that would shrink space-time. So a city, a country like Australia or America would be collapsed, and every distance would be measured in time. So you could go to the farmlands, the mountains, the beaches in record time, and you could bring all of that into your lifestyle and under your control. And, you know, incredibly seductive vision. 5 years later, it was written about by Siegfried Gideon, who's an architectural theorist and historian, and he said that really this idea of space-time had entered the architectural psyche. He relates it to Einstein's theory of relativity, actually, and says that the idea that time is the fourth dimension enters into art with Picasso. You're seeing two moments in time, the time when you saw the woman face on and the time when you saw her side on. The viewer is moved, but two moments in time are captured in the one painting. When we talk about how far is it from here to Tasmania, we don't know in kilometres or miles, but I can tell you it's probably about 2 hours in an aeroplane. We talk about time, space and distance. And then Siegfried Gideon says that this enters architectural theory at the same time as well, so that the itinerary, the movement through a building, is measured now in time. And there's a journey through a building, and the architecture is arranged around that journey. Now, as I said, this is a fabulous idea when it comes to shrinking the countryside. If you want to go to a farm or a mountaintop or participate in any of this sort of exotic recreation, the car is a great machine. And the guy who designed this, Bel Geddes, who designed the Futurama exhibition, was right into streamlining, designing cars and ships. That was his car there. Super fast car and a great way to get to the countryside. This is the exhibition, by the way. Everyone rode on these chairs that sat on something like the luggage carousel and moved you around. Incredibly expensive, sponsored by General Motors, no surprise there. But there were lots of other utopian visions at the time. Frank Lloyd Wright, Le Corbusier, Buckminster Fuller. Everyone had these ideas of the car being linked to architecture and shrinking the countryside. So Frank Lloyd Wright gave us a very unusual looking car. After the war, we'd get suburban sprawl with places like Levittown. And if you want your own house, your own freestanding house, then the car is the way to go. At the time, too, it would have been in living memory, the influenza epidemic of 1918. So people did really want to spread out. You could understand that psychology of wanting to spread out and how the car and the machine were great for that. The problem came with the city, though. You know, the meeting that we're having at the moment or any other thing like it, a school group, a sporting occasion, meeting people to discuss things in a knowledge economy, anything that involves bringing people together, the car is a dead set nuisance. It's like carrying an enormous bunch of, like in a Michelin man suit into a disco. It just doesn't help when you want to get together with other people to have a car involved. And so we see these things that Angelina was speaking about. The effective speed of car travel in Australia's best car city, Canberra, is only 13 kilometres an hour. I can run that. I can ride a bicycle at about 20 kilometres an hour. The average speed of bicycle transport in Copenhagen is 20 kilometres an hour. In Holland, it's about 15. It's quicker than driving. And also, LA, people spend 4 days, the equivalent of 4 days per year, going absolutely nowhere in their car. That's the average driver's experience. And what really annoys me, as a bicycle advocate, is that these cars are getting in my way. Okay? Cars, that's like saying man bites dog, whatever, but, cars are slowing bike transport down. And this is the real... Copenhagen was quicker in the 1930s and 40s when there were no cars on the road. Chinese cities were quicker as well. You look at the way bicycles are slowed down having to wait in intersections in a Chinese city. They all just rode along at 20 kilometres an hour and at any intersection just filtered in turn and kept going, never put their foot down. And now in Copenhagen they have to put their foot down every time they want to turn across traffic because you have this interface. Those cities were faster before cars were introduced. In Copenhagen, they know that the average cyclist can ride at 20 kilometres an hour and they phase the traffic lights to let them keep riding at that speed. Those speeds are probably increasing because bike quality is getting better and better. We're looking at more technologically sophisticated bicycles. We could be upping that, getting above 20 kilometres an hour. And also, these people were riding in cities that were designed for walking, so they're having to do zigzags through the city. Imagine if we could design an urban environment that let people make beelines, that diffuse the traffic rather than herding them into arterial roads where there are bridges, diffuse the traffic and let them make beelines and keep up their 20 kilometres an hour and build a very dense city above that. A city, let's just take a city of half a million people, this city might be almost that size. You could reach the furthest most person in your city if it were compact and let you go at this speed all the way, so much faster than the system that we have at the moment. So that's the ultimate goal here, is to design the city that lets human contact happen far more quickly than we're letting it happen at the moment. Because that's the dream. Speed is the dream. And I'm not saying the car's not the way to go to the beach or the mountaintop, it still is. But to meet people in a city, I think the bicycle is the way to do it, with the right urban morphology that has never been designed for. There's no such thing as a bicycle city. I think this way, let's take one property of bicycles. We know that they don't have much power, so they naturally speed up when they go downhill, and they naturally slow down when they rise up a mound. And imagine the places that we want them to go slow, which is around the entrances to buildings and around shops where you know, cyclists are meeting and becoming pedestrians. And imagine an undulating ground plane that harnesses and releases the potential energy of a cyclist without ever really using your brakes, which is very important when you're a mum with a big load of kids in the front of one of these cargo bikes. So we're thinking this way. We're thinking of the idea of bicycles dropping down into a faster zone using gravity. I'm not talking about, you know, I'm trying to, there's a sweet spot where it works well for people on racing bikes and for people with heavily laden bikes. But the basic idea is that low beams go, so you bring cyclists down for that low area, and high means slow. So we are looking at the high points being places where cyclists slow to the speed of a pedestrian and can mingle with pedestrians. And then when the pedestrians have to cross over, they take a higher route. So that's, you know, it's not strictly segregated, but you're encouraging people to work with the city that way. Now, I've got to say, these are... don't see these as actual designs for any actual city. We're working on it like a kit of tools, like the basic components of an architectural vocabulary, the component parts that you would put together in more contextual and subtle ways than this. So it all looks very Spartan at the moment. Certainly keen on the idea of riding inside. Horses, when bikes replaced horses, they were kept outside because their forebears used to poo on the floor. Bikes don't kick anybody and they don't poo on the floor. And they're no worse than strollers in terms of their impact on the internal flooring. So we bring bikes all the way into your apartment so you can unload your shopping immediately into your apartment. And we do that too, and I think as an architect, my profession really, what we try and do is we try and make people live longer by creating buildings that reduce disease. We've done that by bringing toilets and basins inside so that you wash your hands naturally, not because you're a germphobe. We think that bikes should likewise be the natural choice and that architecture can incentivise cycling just the same as it incentivises hand washing, and that that would reduce chronic disease. I'm just about to submit a paper to the American Journal of Public Health with a colleague of mine at the Harvard School of Public Health, making this point, looking at bike parking inside of buildings and its history. If you can do that, you see, and I think of this as a parent, if I'm looking after Junior and I can put Junior to sleep in the box bike, as many Dutch people do, in the kitchen and ride out to the shops and ride back, I can have the baby sleep while I shop. And especially if the cycling is done undercover, you know, the parent's life becomes more efficient, far more efficient than the parent's life with a car. That's what we're competing against. And then when I get to the shops, I want to be able to use my bicycle as a shopping trolley as well, not to be forced to leave the bike outside, as the Dutch have done, because they've just replaced horses with bikes. And then we start to explain the buildings that are in front of you. And again, remember, they're ideas for buildings. You know, all architects work with types, building types, and then we translate those into actual buildings. So if we're just thinking about the type... one type that's quite well known among architects is the slab block. It's very efficient. You orient this so that every apartment is licked with a bit of sun each day and there's privacy, and, you know, every architect knows about that. Now, what if we took that and tilted it, and now what I'm calling is this series of slippage manoeuvres where you let each floor slide down until it touches the ground so that you can ride directly into the access corridor and ride your bicycle up a very wide access corridor that's wide enough for deliveries to be made. Bring your bike all the way up to your apartment, and every single row, every floor plate, and the top floor plate's a special triple layer one with a central access balcony and then these what we call crossover apartments. Bring them all down to the ground and finally a tongue at the end. So you can, it's a bike access apartment. That's what we're thinking of. There's another type. So the building that we have here, it's got two types that we're looking at. We all know a row of terraces. A row of terraces is very practical, high density. Not quite dense enough, though. So take a row of terraces, put a bit of a slope on it, coil it, pack it down neatly, open it out to the sun, and voila, you have what we call a velo home. A row of terraces, you can ride all the way to the top. have a pub at the top, whatever you want. And this is a section through it. So we've got bike track on the inside, pedestrian, a rough texted pedestrian track there that the cyclist doesn't want to ride on. Bike parking, and then bike parking inside the apartment, and then the bedrooms cantilevered back out for privacy. The important thing with these two is that we're making sure they all comply with the Australian Building Code, which is the most stringent in the world, actually, in terms of fire egress and sun access. So if it works in Australia, it'll work anywhere. So that's the Vela home. Am I crazy? Well, the problem is that utopian dreamers have been given a bad rap by some really crazy utopian dreamers, Paolo Saleri with Arcosanti, and this guy, Jacques Fresco, who dreams of a future when we don't work at all. And in some respects, I appreciate that I am a bit like these guys. And these guys are being deliberately provocative. And provocation is the starting point. Without a provocation, and hopefully one that captures the cultural, like the people's imagination, without that, we just keep doing the same old thing, which is a problem, because if we keep doing the same old thing, we get the same old problems. And we know that cars aren't working for us if we want to bring people together in the city. It's because they take up so much space. The car plus its braking space, if it were charged for, if drivers were paying rent for the space they're using, it would be prohibitively expensive. And then the alternative is transit-oriented development, which has two major problems with it. The Dutch, who have built their country around transit-oriented development, they survey their population and they find that nobody likes it. That cramming onto the train is horrible, fearful, it has all these negative associations. Bikes are the things that people really like. And the other problem with it is that if we do this sort of spoke and node kind of planning, transit-oriented development, then we're cramming people onto trains and we're having them walk there. Walking increases your metabolic equivalent of task, three times what it is at the moment, just sitting here. Walking upstairs and cycling increases it by on average 7 or 8 times. It's the only way as a society where we don't work physically to make our money anymore that we can burn off enough calories to be able to have a decent meal and a biscuit. And that's why we are all putting on weight, because we have built environments that aren't letting us really burn off those calories. So I sort of look at it this way, and it's, you know, this is maybe biased, whatever, but I look at all the negative associations with driving. You just wouldn't base a city around driving anymore with all of the negatives. Transit has a few negatives, causes stress, it's obesogenic and it's very expensive. Walking is great, seems to have a clear bill of health apart from, you know, maybe it's a little bit obesogenic, but it certainly has limited range. Walking's fine if you've got a city of like 1,000 people, but above that, it's just not going to get you the choice of schools and jobs that you want from a city. Cycling is really worth considering as a basis for urban development. We know that already there are places where apartments are being built around bike infrastructure and no other form of infrastructure, and they're selling. So Minneapolis Midtown Greenway is the best example of that. So people are voting with their hip pockets and buying this sort of stuff. I don't know about my spelling before I go to bed late at night putting these slides together, but anyway, architects are excited about it. There are lots of, I follow these trends in the architectural world, bikes-focused buildings. Now, just the stuff that we're looking at here, my understanding was that the exhibition of bikes that you have was on its way to Fremantle, but it works for any large brownfield site. We just tested these, sort of just plonking these buildings down on Fremantle. So just north of Fremantle there, there's a big, you know, very redundant, contaminated brownfield site. Every Australian city's got these. Conventional wisdom would say, build a train station here, expect that people want to walk to the beach, have a row of shops in between. The shops might be, you know, 30 seconds apart. That would work as the first stroke in an urban design thing, and then have all the apartments radiate around that. If you look at it though, the bulk haulage routes that made this a really good site for industry are the same easements through the city that make it a really good site to run bike highways, covered, backdrafted bike highways if you've got the money. I haven't looked more broadly for other cities that I've lived in and looked at more closely. I've looked more broadly, and this is Newcastle, where I grew up, and you can map it out and look at a broad bicycle plan. I've only really looked at this site and its immediate connections. But the basic idea would be to say that the shops don't need to be gathered up because everyone's moving at bike speed, so you spread the shops and the entry foyers apart. They're still only a few seconds apart, but because you're on a bike, you can spread them out, which is nice because you can activate the entire site. You don't have dead parts of the site and lively parts. It's all lively. And then because low means go, and the opposite from when you slow down, you raise all of those shops up on mounds so that you're slowing the bikes down when they come to those entry points and shops. So you have this field of like mounds or moguls. You work at providing covered routes to keep the cyclists out of the rain, but also grade separation for pedestrians so they can stay on the high, slow area. In a very crude sort of manner, just oriented to the sun, you drop these apartments down. The nice thing about the slip block form is that it gives apartments a bit of an outlook, even though they're parallel to each other. And then the next big question is whether all of those people aged 8 to 80 who can enjoy bicycle transport, which is the widest age range possible as well, whether what they think about it. Really, that's the next step that Angelina and I want to work towards, is really getting public involved in interrogating this and refining it as a collaborative venture.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you very much. We've got 15 or 20 minutes for a bit of discussion, so I'd like to open it up for questions. Well, I have a few, but please, I'll go first.
Yes, I haven't been to Houghton, but I know about Houghton.
Yeah. Yeah,
Milton Keynes in Britain is very similar as well, but still it's designed for the bikes and the cars and the pedestrians and the transit, and trying not really to prioritise one over the other. I certainly think it's a great city, and I'd move there in a flash compared to any Australian city.
Yeah.
I'd love to live there, but I don't think it really rationally follows through the premise of a bike-focused city to its logical conclusion in a purely rational way. It inherits a lot of ideas still from the walking city and the horse city.
Yeah, it was a medieval town, but then they expanded on it. So all cars are forced out to the ring road, so you can't actually drive. So.
Yeah. Well, Groningen is the same.
Yeah.
And but it's still, it's not really looking at it. It's not taking it to its furthest conclusion because it's still dogged by a lot of old ideas,
yeah.
I think.
And then there's Auburn and Germany that made it particularly, like, you can't drive, you park near your apartment or your house. It's situated at four corners.
Again, the problem is, too, is that it's incentivising cycling by punishing driving rather than really saying driving's an option. And the cities we've got here, driving is certainly an option. It's built for driving. Can we do a city that's actually better? See, those cities are still putting cyclists in the rain, which doesn't bother a lot of cyclists, obviously. But when you've got the choice of taking a kid to school out of the rain, and all the other transport options provide that, it's not doing it. Yeah. I think they're great, but I do think we can do better.
Oh, yeah.
And they obviously haven't caught the public imagination, otherwise we'd be replicating them here.
Well, that's a cop, not really.
Well, I don't know if it's the public imagination, so I guess it's still this.
We'd love to see the bike industry unite in the way the car industry has. You know, if they really united behind transport cycling and sponsored something, okay, they can't compete with General Motors and the 1939... Futurama exhibition, that was enormous. But imagine something one-tenth of its scale, using digital technology, we can, you know, I can put all of this in a computer and put people all around the world on a bicycle wearing headphones, and you can navigate the environment on a bicycle. You know, I use this machine for training. You can immerse people in it for far less of a cost than it costs to put on the Futurama. And just open people's eyes to the possibility, you know.
Isn't the Velo City Conference part of the building?
The Velo City Conference?
Yeah, they're on that whole building.
Yeah, yeah, it's coming to Adelaide.
And it doesn't, you know, it's not like a huge display park.
It's probably a good thing. We'll see what happens in Adelaide next year as to whether it really impacts the Australian media. I'm sure it will, to a point. Maybe we should be getting those guys to... Yeah, look, that's an interesting one. I think at the moment it
really...
No, it needs to be market-driven,
yeah.
You know. You meet enough people in the market saying, we want to do... You know, it's the kind of thing that if it happens anywhere at the moment, it would be China or some, you know, dictatorship in South America, I think, is our best chance at the moment. But we would like to think that an exhibition is the next step, you see. So we look at the history of car-centred development, and it was these exhibitions and utopian visions that were the precursors to the big shift in the post-war era. So this is an essential step.
And this is where, at the same time, kind of visionary ideas of their places, of their
particular environments. So I might just follow up on that. Okay. Sorry. do you want to go? I was just going to make a point about, I guess, in speaking up with museums in this context, because I think what we do very well is provide a historical context to a lot of these ideas. And, I mean, one of them that struck me about particularly looking at the 1938 World Fair, was that how all these ideas about cars were very similar to the ideas that were spoken about bicycles. Bicycles annihilated space and time, and this is precisely the language that they used in late 19th century. You know, the response was, you know, culturally and economically was astonishing. And, you know, people, the language they used to describe the distances between cities across the countries were framed around bicycle journeys, often by kind of heroic journeys made by Hubert Opperman and people like that.
Yeah, right.
And I think what you're, I guess, grappling with is how you kind of reconnect with those historical ideas and essentially reactivate them. And that's where I think, you know, museums really have a powerful role to play, kind of unpacking those ideas. And particularly when it comes to kind of the embodied experience with objects, bicycles and with cars, museums can do that very well. Where I think people, in one sense, what we're talking about kind of collides with that very powerful idea about modernity and what our body should be doing. And the trajectory of modernity has been that our body should be passive,
mm-hmm.
An idealised, successful future was based on a passive body. And you ever looked at that, the way those people moved around that exhibition in 1939, they're all in little trolleys. Like their bodies were passive,
mm-hmm.
when they were experiencing,
yeah.
it. And, you know, that was the height of kind of, you know, futuristic success.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's a whole range of things that you need to tackle to kind of re-engage with our bodies. And a part of that, I think, is you know, probably a health crisis that is coming, just as there is one about climate,
yeah.
that we may not have the luxury of kind of, you know, toying with the ideas. It may arrive and we will have to deal with it.
Yeah. It's always struck me that this is the motor. That
a car
has got two motors, one that's just wearing out the more you use it, and this one that's dying because it's not being used. And you take that motor away and you've got a much more efficient vehicle.
But I guess the question is, do you build something like this and then just let the culture follow? Mm. Or
so what's our Jane Fonda moment?
One of my design team is a guy who's a really keen mountain bike rider and a daredevil, you know, it's an adrenaline sport. And he looks at this, and you know what we don't, what we've deliberately avowed here is the details. But he looks at this and thinks about where the trails and where the jumps and where the berms would be, and then how that would, there'd be another layer that was about mums and kids and shopping, and you know there'd be another layer that was a promenading one, so we could all be on upright bikes with our suits and being seen, you know. And I think that's the. It's very diverse though. There's no one image, you know. Bicycling is divided with a lot of different tribes, and there's different joy in all of those bicycling styles. And this looks really Stalinist, because this is the way we've approached it, just this rational sort of skeleton for the whole thing. But when we get into the details, that's what we want to pursue next, is where is the fun and the joy within that. I'm also, you know, I'm terrified of cars. You know, I'm a parent and I've got kids, and it was when I started riding the bike with the kids and taking them out on the road, I was fine being a lone warrior by myself. But as a dad and a husband, it was a different story. And I don't see much hope. They've been trying to, for 40 years to inspire people to cycle with cars, and it's not catching on. So the places that did catch on, I look at, say, Copenhagen, where they had Christiania, which was a, you know, an enclave which was car-free. And that seems to be a common ingredient, that you get these areas which are like a catalyst then. And the rest of Copenhagen, 2 years after Christiania, started demonstrating for pushing the cars out of the way. So it was like a beacon for change. And I do see the brownfields, which are being renewed and regenerated with all of these car-free promenades, as being like a beacon. In the city of Newcastle, where I'm from, the brownfield, the former Docklands, was just bike city, it turned into. Everyone was coming out. All the girls were coming out on their bikes in high heels so they could ride home drunk and ride between bars, you know. And it was safe and friendly and inviting, and it was really then becomes a bit of a beacon. Then you see the hipster districts and the other places, bikes starting to spread into those areas. But without some place that really is psychologically welcoming to cyclists, you know, yeah.
I'm just conscious of the time, so as much as I don't want to wrap up the discussion, can you please join me in thanking Angelina and Stephen for their terrific talk?
Thanks, Stephen.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.